Yeah, you're on.
Okay, guys, so we're going to start. My name is Dr. Alexis. I'm one of the attendings in the oncology hematology department. And as sort of one of your beginning lectures early in the year, we like to talk about oncologic emergencies. So I'm going to go over basically just a few topics, review the basics, and the point of these lectures is that you think about certain things in cancer patients when you admit them, when they come in with certain symptoms. So we'll talk about spinal cord compression first. So spinal cord compression is a problem in approximately 1 to 5% of patients with systemic cancers. And again, the reason we present this is because it must be treated immediately to avoid long-term neurological sequelae. It can lead to irreversible paralysis as well as loss of bowel and bladder function. The most common cause is actually due to tumor that invades the vertebra and resulting in collapsed fragments and compression of the epidural space. So the most common sites, the thoracic spine is probably the most common, 70% of cases, followed by lumbar sacral, and less likely cervical, though it has happened and can occur. The most common malignancies are listed there. As you can tell, it's a relatively long list. So when the symptoms, when the patient comes in with the correct symptoms and they have a history of cancer, I tend to include it on my differential diagnosis. So lung, breast, cancer of unknown primary, prostate, renal, multiple myeloma, lymphomas. So symptoms and signs. So a patient initially tends to present with pain that's localized to the spine. Back pain is one of those red flag symptoms for oncologists. When we have patients, especially patients with metastatic cancer, especially patients with cancer metastatic to the bones, when they complain of back pain, that raises a red flag for us. And again, the reason that you oftentimes, you know, someone might come in with back pain and, you know, a resident or a fellow might say, but they don't have neurological dysfunction, right? Why go ahead with the, you know, an extensive workup, etc.? Well, the whole point of it is that you want to get to these patients in terms of treatment before it progresses to the point of neurological dysfunction, because the prognosis is much better if the person walks in with their spinal cord compression versus obviously if they're coming in and they're already paralyzed. So think of, you have a cancer patient with metastatic disease especially, and they're complaining of back pain. You have to include that on your differential. The pain tends to be exacerbated by movement, recumbency, sort of coughing, sneezing, straining. And again, the second bullet point underneath pain in the spine is this may appear weeks to months before any neurological symptoms. So it's something you want to pay attention to. Radicular pain is another sign. Weakness with sensory loss, and they can have autonomic dysfunction. And this is usually later in the course. Now, I want to bring up the point, a lot of times when we, you know, you're doing a review of system or something, have back pain, what we tend to do is we say, well, do you have any, you know, are you losing stool or are you incontinent of urine or stool? What I want to point out is that these patients can present with urinary retention and constipation, okay? So evaluation. You really want to do a good physical exam, especially a neurological exam. You want to gently percuss the spinal column. You want to see if there is tenderness at any under any particular vertebra. That might lead you, let's say you find something a sensory level when you do your neurological exam, you might be able to correlate that with any tenderness that you found in percussing the spinal column. You do passive neck flexion, straight leg raise, and again, motor and sensory exam. Now, I put rectal exam in bold there because sometimes, you know, we can all tend to get kind of lazy and, you know, someone comes in back pain, you don't always want to go ahead and do a rectal exam. Well, in this particular situation, it's part of doing a good neurological assessment. Doing a rectal exam to assess rectal tone. You want to assess for anesthesia in that area, okay? So the one point that I want to make is when you're going to image the spine, even if you think based on your exam that the person may have, say, a thoracic lesion or a lumbar sacral lesion, you really want to image the entire spine. Why? Well, for one of the reasons is that a third of patients who have cord compression due to malignancy, a third of them will have some lesion in another area of the spine. And you don't want to go ahead planning and giving treatment for one area while you're ignoring something that might be occurring higher up. So when you send the person for imaging, image the entire spine if you're ruling out a cord compression. Now, MRI is the gold standard. I'll talk about the other two for a second. Doing an X-ray, might be a nice thing to do while you're waiting the MRI. It may add to your suspicion, but the fact that someone has a negative X-ray of the spine doesn't rule out a cord compression, obviously. What it might tell you is, because we know most cord compressions occur because there's some kind of vertebral collapse where the bone is invaded by tumor and compression of the spine that way, that on the X-ray you may see that. You may see a collapsed vertebrae, you may see some abnormal vertebral bony disease, but again, it's really not the test you want. It may add to the clinical suspicion you already have, but you're gonna, if you suspect cord compression, you're gonna have to get the MRI. CT scans, I'm going to go down to CT scans, have been used. They're not as good as MRI in terms of actually imaging the spinal cord and the epidural space, etc. So your gold standard exam is your MRI, radiological imaging is your MRI. So the goal of treatment. Obviously, you want recovery and maintenance of normal neurological function. You want to assess for stabilization of the spine. Local tumor control is one of your goals as well. And pain control. Obviously, you want the patient to be feeling better. Your treatment outcome will depend on the degree of neurological impairment at presentation, which goes back to my original point. You want to catch these people. You want to think about this before the person is paraplegic or has, really severe neurological dysfunction. The treatment outcome will also depend on the radiosensitivity of the tumor, because radiation is such a crucial part to treating cord compression. So the treatment. If you suspect a cord compression, even before you get your MRI, because in most hospitals, you're going to have to wait, several hours at least before you get that MRI. If you suspect an MRI, you're going to start the person on steroids, okay? Now, the standard is sort of give 10 milligrams IV push, and then you give 16 milligrams in divided doses daily. However, if someone has severe neurological impairment, and you can talk to the neurologist about that, I'll get to that later, higher doses of steroids may be used. For instance, this 10 milligrams IV push with the 4 milligrams IV Q 6 hours after that might be okay if someone has, you think they might have a little bit of weakness, maybe in their lower extremities, they're +4/5, you're not too sure, but no major, you can't find any huge major neurological deficits. If someone's coming in totally paraplegic, bowel and bladder dysfunction, you might want to discuss using a higher dose. Some people have used as high as 96 milligrams initially, then 25 milligrams to Q6. So if there's severe neurological impairment, you're probably going to discuss with the neurologist and the oncologist going with a higher dose of steroids. Now, apart from the steroid, the central modalities of treatment for spinal cord compression tends to be surgery and radiation. And we'll get to, when we do one, when we do both in a second. When is radiation used? Radiation is used if the person is considered to have a stable spine with a radiosensitive tumor. If they have an unstable spine, but for whatever reason they can't go to the OR to stabilize their spine, you'd use radiation. And the port includes the radiation port, the area that's treated, includes the area of epidural involvement plus two vertebral bodies above and below that area. Surgery comes into play when a tissue diagnosis is needed. There are going to be a certain number of patients where their initial presentation of their cancer is with a cord compression. So these are people who are coming in with signs of a cord compression. You image them, you find a cord compression, but they have no diagnosis of cancer. So this is their presenting sign, if you will. So in that case, you need a tissue diagnosis in those individuals, so surgery will come into play then. If there is spinal instability, the person, as long as they're a surgical candidate, they can tolerate the procedure, they need to go to the OR to stabilize your spine. If the person's had prior radiation to an affected area, it's not unheard of that patients with a history of cancer, they have a cord compression, they're treated with radiation, and the tumor recurs in the same area. There's only so much radiation that you can give to, you know, a certain of your body parts, the spine included. So if the person has had maximum radiation therapy to that particular area and they recur in that area, you probably have to consider surgery at that point. If you have someone, you're treating them with steroids, you're treating them with radiation, and their neurological symptoms are progressing despite your treatment, that's also a situation where you might want to consider surgery. So what sort of the thing you do? So when you come, I'll go to the next slide, then I'll come back to this one. So someone comes in, you suspect cord compression, you do your exam, you set up the MRI, you start them on steroids. I want to point out that there should be multidisciplinary management. So you get your neurologist on board as well. Because, you know, we all do our neurological exam and we try to do very good exams. But, you know, again, they do a very detailed exam and sometimes they can pick up on deficits that we might have missed. Oncology consult, of course. Neurosurgery consult, very important. Oftentimes the house staff, they call us, which is appropriate, and we come see the patient, and then we're trying to call neurosurgery. We should probably, if there's evidence of cord compression, call neurosurgery immediately, because again, they have to assess the patient to see if the person has any spinal instability, because that might be an indication to take the patient to the OR. Whether or not they do that, beyond the person having a stable spine or not, whether or not they go in and resect will depend on the type of malignancy, the patient themselves, what they deem the prognosis of the patient to be after the resection, and also radiology consultation. Well, usually we come in before that, so we'll usually get radiation oncology. But I would say the key people you want on board are your oncologist, your neurologist, and definitely neurosurgery as well. So I'm going to go back to the previous slide. So the second bullet point that mentions resection followed by radiation versus radiation alone. When do we use both? When do we use only one? So I sort of reviewed just generally when neurosurgery would be indicated and when radiation would be indicated. So how about putting them together? There was a study that looked at about 100 and some patients who were coming in with malignancy, coming in with neurological symptoms from cord compression, and they were randomized to radical resection followed by radiation versus radiation alone. And in that study, it showed, they actually stopped this study early, because in the combined modality arm, the patients who got their tumor resected, the tumors resected that was causing their cord compression, those patients had a higher ambulatory rate than the patient who got radiation alone, and they retained ability to walk better. So basically, whenever the person's possibly a surgical candidate, we tend to go that route. If we think they can tolerate the procedure, there is data that actually resecting that tumor, if you think the person can tolerate the procedure, if you think they'll have a decent prognosis, resecting the tumor and then following that up with radiation is better for the patient in terms of radiation alone. Now, again, the same factors we talked about in terms of what they were like neurologically when they came in, the type of cancer, et cetera, that affected also who did better in the long run in terms of walking and in terms of maintaining their ability to ambulate. Any questions so far? No? Okay. So I'll go ahead to SVC syndrome. So the first slide sort of brings to mind in terms of SVC syndrome, there are sort of two broad categories in terms of causes, malignant causes and non-malignant causes. So I'm an oncologist, so when I see a patient, I'm always thinking cancer, right? But it's important to remember that there are other non-cancer causes of SVC syndrome as well. In terms of malignant causes, intrathoracic malignancies, as you can imagine, from an anatomical standpoint, it makes sense. Those are kind of the tumors that are going to cause SVC syndrome. Lung cancer can cause it. It's more common in small cell lung cancer, likely because small cell lung cancer tends to grow more centrally than peripherally, so it tends to be a more central tumor. Breast cancer when it metastasizes, testicular cancer because it can have mediastinal involvement, thymomas or another group, lymphomas as well, or any malignancy that can cause large degree of metastases to the mediastinum or tends to develop in that area. Non-malignant causes. Thrombosis, a common cause in cancer patients, you have to keep it in mind. And then there are sort of other things to think about. Again, if the patient doesn't already have a cancer diagnosis, you have your TB. Prior radiation therapy is something to think about because there can be post-radiation fibrosis and sclerosis and things like sarcoidosis. So the signs and symptoms. It's a long list, but so you can have facial edema, erythema, dilatation of the veins of the upper body, laryngeal edema, periodontal edema, etc. When you see the patient, a lot of times, if you're thinking about SVC syndrome, it's probably because the patient has some kind of symptom, or B, you've noticed something on their exam, either facial swelling, or the veins in the upper part of the body seem more dilated, etc. SVC syndrome actually has a grading system, graded in grade 1 to grade 5, grade 1 being less symptoms, grade 5 being death actually, grade 4 is something like coma due to cerebral edema. And the grading system is important because basically many years ago, any SVC syndrome was essentially considered a medical emergency. You gave RT right away, you took the person to stent right away. Now there's sort of data that suggests that maybe for people who do not have a serious degree of symptoms, you can take the time to do certain things prior to rushing someone off to radiation therapy. I'm going to get to that in a second. The symptoms of SVC syndrome tend to be worse with positional changes, such as bending forward, stooping, or lying down. You want to act on it because you don't want to get to the point where it's, grade 4 or 5, where you have life-threatening cerebral edema, or where you have laryngeal edema or airway compromise. So what's your diagnostic evaluation. So you want to determine the etiology of the SVC syndrome, right? Because as I mentioned, not all of it is going to be due to cancer. So you're going to do a thorough physical exam, as I'm sure you all do. Your chest x-ray may show mediastinal widening. It may not. If you suspect that there might be a thrombus, for example, if the person has a catheter, an ultrasound might be helpful in that respect. It might be able to help you differentiate a thrombus from some kind of extrinsic compression. A CT scan is probably the most useful situation in that setting, contrast-enhanced CT scan, because again, that will help you see if there's anything there in the chest that's causing extrinsic compression versus something else that might be intravascular. Bronchoscopy, thoracoscopy, I put those lower down. Those are basically if you're working someone up, you don't have a diagnosis yet. But I'd say maybe, you're shooting for a CT scan with MRI, maybe a Doppler ultrasound. If the person has a catheter, you want to rule out a thrombosis. So treatment. So the goal of treatment is to alleviate symptoms, but you also want to keep in mind what the underlying disease is because you always want to address that situation. The initial management will depend on your grade of the SVC syndrome. So obviously if someone has grade 4 symptoms, if the person's dizzy, passing out, there's some CNS symptoms from the SVC syndrome, that's someone you have to act on immediately, right? That's not someone you're gonna, you know, let hang out for a couple of days while you try to figure out, is it from a breast cancer, is it from, you know. So you want to address that initially. In terms of determining the underlying cause, you want to, the CT scan will help you with that. The patient history will help you with that as well. And the last bullet point that I have in terms of treatment is you want to define what your treatment goal is. Is this cure? Is this palliation? And the reason I bring that up is, let's say you have someone who is initially presenting with SVC syndrome from, let's say, lymphoma. Right? Many types of lymphomas are very chemotherapy sensitive. And let's say that person only has disease in the chest that's causing an SVC syndrome, that person might be curable with chemotherapy. So you'll not only relieve their symptoms, but you might actually be able to do something that's very long term for that patient. Compare that with your person who's, let's say, has metastatic breast cancer, who's had four lines of chemotherapy and is now presenting with SVC syndrome from a large mass in the chest that never responded to therapy in the first place, right? That's a totally different situation. So you want to sort of address, based on the patient's history and what they look like coming in, what your goals are. Like, do you just want to palliate this person, or is there a chance for cure in this person? So just simple things like elevation of the head of the bed, or to sat, O2 and bed rest, or sort of inertia. Now, the treatment modalities that we use. So, radiation therapy. So, radiation therapy can play two roles. It can play a role in terms of palliation, especially if you have a radiosensitive tumor. Especially if you have a radiosensitive tumor, and also in terms of cure. Because, again, for tumors like small cell lung cancer, that's, let's say, limited to one side of the chest. Actually, the definitive treatment for that is chemotherapy plus radiation therapy. So it could play a role in that setting. One of the things that sort of changed in terms of the way we look at SVC syndrome, again, ordinarily someone comes in and, you know, maybe you can't get a, you know, get them to have a stent done fast enough. You rush them off to radiation. Now we sort of say, if you don't have an underlying cancer diagnosis and the person's relatively stable, meaning that they don't have like grade 3 or grade 4 SVC syndrome, maybe they have a little bit of edema but they're otherwise doing well, the recommendation now is that you take the time, if the person is stable, again, that's very important, you have to use your clinical judgment, grade their SVC syndrome. If the person is stable, you take the time to get an accurate histologic diagnosis on these people before rushing them off to radiation therapy. And again, that depends on the clinical status of the person, that they're actually stable, that they're not having any CNS symptoms from their SVC syndrome, etc. If it's life-threatening, obviously, you do what you have to do. Stenting is generally used for patients with life-threatening symptoms. Why? Because it works, and it works fast. So if you're in a position where you can, that person can have an endovascular stent placed and, you know, they have really severe life-threatening symptoms, that's a course we should try to pursue. Again, because it works and it works fairly quickly. You obviously still, if it's a SVC syndrome from malignancy, you still haven't dealt with the underlying cause, but you're trying to stem, right, a catastrophic event from happening. Chemotherapy. Now, again, as I mentioned, there are some cancers that can cause SVC syndrome that are pretty chemosensitive. So you want to, if you can, get in there and treat with chemotherapy, especially if the person's otherwise stable, and especially also if they've never been treated before. So your lymphomas, your germ cell tumors are extremely chemosensitive, and small cell lung cancer carries a bad prognosis, but generally chemosensitive initially. Thrombolysis is something to think about. It has been done before in patients who have a very large thrombus. If the person has a catheter that's causing, you know, a thrombus and creating the problem, generally you would want to try to have the catheter removed. And the other things that have been reported, diuretics have been used in some centers. There's no real evidence, I would say, that it does much of anything in terms of improving outcome, but it might be something that you'll read or that will come up. Steroids are sort of always routinely used. In terms of what they actually do in terms of improving symptoms in SVC syndrome, I would say it's more to do in association with, let's say, the person getting radiation therapy. Well, when people get radiation, there's usually some edema, et cetera, that results from that. So steroids are probably not a bad idea in that setting. So I'm going to talk, I'll come back to hypercalcemia. I want to do tumor lysis syndrome first and then neutropenic fever. So tumor lysis syndrome. So by strict definition, it refers to the triad of hyperuricemia, hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia. It can lead to renal failure and hypocalcemia, secondary complications. Why does it happen? Well, chemotherapeutic agents cause cell lysis and cell death. So you get, obviously, release of the intracellular components into the bloodstream. You get breakdown of your nucleic acid. You get catabolism of hypoxanthine and xanthines, and that leads to your elevated uric acid levels. Potassium and phosphate are also present in high levels in the cytoplasm, and they're released as well. LDH, it's not officially part of the syndrome, but it's something that we follow, again, because it tends to be high in tumor lysis syndrome, and it's something that we can follow. So what are the risk factors or signs or symptoms? So you want to watch for it in terms of patients who are coming in who, and I should also mention, there are people who have very rapidly dividing tumors, such as your very high-grade lymphomas. So lymphomas can be low-grade, they can be high-grade, and then they can be very high-grade. So your really aggressive tumors, your Burkitt's and your lymphoblastic lymphomas. These cells are dividing so rapidly that they can have what we call Basically, it's tumor lysis that occurs in the absence of treatment, because as the cells are rapidly dividing so quickly, some of them are going to die as well. So these individuals can also present with tumor lysis syndrome even prior to treatment. So you want to suspect and look for it in people who have high LDH coming in, they have a high uric acid coming in, or an abnormal creatinine. So they are at risk. If they have bulky, rapidly proliferating tumors that you're going to treat with chemotherapy. So when we worry about it, again, as I mentioned, in your patients with very high-grade lymphomas, in your patients with acute leukemias who are coming in with very high white counts, those patients are also at risk. And again, the third bullet point most often occurs in treatment of leukemias and high-grade lymphomas. The cardiac arrhythmias occur, but generally in the setting of metabolic abnormalities. And again, tetany, the same. Renal failure in the setting of hyperuricemia and hypophosphatemia. So what we want to do with tumor lysis syndrome is we want to have options, right? You want to prophylax, so you want to prevent it from happening, and then you want to know what to do if it does happen. So the first part of prophylaxis is obviously you have to know the patients who are at risk, right? So we sort of talked about the characteristics of the patients who might be at risk. Then you want to give vigorous prehydration. Allopurinol is the drug we most commonly use in terms of prophylaxis for tumor lysis syndrome. What does it do? It inhibits xanthine oxidase. So that's the enzyme that breaks down hypoxanthine and xanthine to uric acid. So if you inhibit that, you inhibit new uric acid formation. So that's an important point, though, because of the way allopurinol works, it'll inhibit new uric acid formation. It won't be able to get rid of any uric acid that's already there. So if you're using allopurinol, it's purely in the prophylactic setting, meaning you're preventing worsening of stuff. But if the person has a uric acid of like 7 or 8 already, that's not going to help you that much. And you want to really do careful metabolic monitoring. When I'm on the 5D service, what we tend to do is in patients who we think are at risk with tumor lysis, or we're about to treat them, we generally check their labs, maybe BID initially, and then follow daily once they stabilize. That's for our high-risk patient. The patients are already coming in with high LDH and rapidly growing tumor. In terms of treatment, so remember I said the way allopurinol works by inhibiting xanthine oxidase, it only really prevents new uric acid formation. If the person's already in tumor lysis, you need something that actually breaks down the uric acid. And that's what resveratrol does. So resveratrol actually breaks down, degrades the uric acid, and makes it into a more water-soluble form that can be excreted. If you use resveratrol, you want to check, especially in the right patient, you want to check for G6PD deficiency because it's contraindicated in G6PD deficiency. There's hydrogen peroxide produces a byproduct that causes pretty severe hemolysis in those patients. So you want to pay attention to that. Again, and sometimes what I've done in the high-risk patient, especially if it's a person in the right ethnic group, et cetera, that even though I may not plan to use resveratrol at that moment, just do a G6PD screening because you never know what's going to happen in the course of therapy. So skip that. Okay. So I'm going to go to neutropenic fever, which is a very important onc emergency. And I'm sure, I mean, you're just starting out, but you may have encountered. Sometimes you don't have to be oncology to encounter the neutropenic fever. So it's a medical emergency, and I want you to think about it in that way. And the reason that I'm stressing this is because, you know, when we think about things of medical emergencies, we move faster and we try to get things done faster. So I want you to really think about neutropenic fever in that way. These people can be very sick, and, you know, what's even scarier is, you know, they can get, even if they don't, they only look mildly sick initially, they can get very sick in a short period of time. Officially, it's defined as ANC less than 1,000, so you're multiplying your WEC by the percentage of neutrophils in bands. What I want to point out to you is whenever you have, you know, a patient, just not just oncology patients, but, you know, just any of your patients, don't just look at the WBC, always look at the differential as well. Right? Because, you know, WBC of 3, you know, that looks normal. I mean, it's the lower limit of normal, but it looks normal. But you want to know what your percentage of neutrophils is. So always pay attention, not just to the WBC, but pay attention as well to what your differential is. A neutropenic fever is officially defined as a temp greater than 101.3 or a sustained temperature of 100.4 or more for more than an hour. For clinical purposes, I will be honest with you, on the oncology surface, we tend not to, like, if someone has a temp, if they're neutropenic, let's say their ANC is 500 and their temp is 100.5 or 100.6, we generally don't wait until we take another temp of, like, you know 100.6, like 4 hours later. We call it neutropenic fever and we proceed accordingly. But I just put what the official definition up there is there so you know about it. But it, generally, I think what most people do in clinical practice, if someone has a temp of greater than 100.4, and they're, especially if they're severely neutropenic, it's considered that, and you initiate your treatment and your evaluation as such. Now, the fourth bullet point, I want you to remember that there may still be an infection in the absence of fevers. Okay, so think about that, especially if you have an elderly patient. They may not always express the infection in terms of having a temp of 101. And I also want you to remember that some of these patients are on steroids as well for one reason or another. And they may also not manifest as a high fever. So your clinical judgment will also come into play there as well. You may look at the patient even though they don't have a fever, but if they're neutropenic and they look sick or they looked not well, or they tell you they feel different, or they have certain signs or symptoms, you err on the side of treating that patient. It may present with hyperthermia, hypotension, and rapid clinical deterioration. And again, when someone has neutropenic fever, you want to start broad-spectrum antibiotics as soon as possible. What I always tell the house staff on the 5D service is it's one of those situations, and, you know, we're all house officers at one point, and you write an order for antibiotic, and then the nurse picks it up, and then she calls in the pharmacy, and then the pharmacy, you know, brings it, you know, sends it down, some waiting for somebody to pick it up, and then they hang it, and, you know, by the time all that's done, like, you know, it could be long time that has elapsed. So what I tell the house staff, and you know, that's fine maybe in your patient who has a little, you know, cough and you treat a pneumonia and, you know, they're not neutropenic and they look otherwise well. What I say to the house staff, your neutropenic fever patient, you don't just write the order for the antibiotics, you sort of, you write the order, you tell the nurse, this is someone who's neutropenic, you want it hung, you double check and you do a follow-up, has it been hung yet? And you know, how staff on 5D also know if it's taking too long, you go get it yourself. The nurse can hang that medication because you really don't want hours to elapse before someone gets started on antibiotics and you know, they go downhill. I just want to make that point. So the risk factors for occult infection. So it's affected by the degree of neutropenia, how rapid the decline was in neutrophil count. A prolonged duration of neutropenia is a bad sign. If they have malignancy that's not in remission, other comorbid illnesses, peripheral lines, central accesses, central venous catheters, and also monoclonal antibodies can add to the risk, basically because they, in some cases, for instance, rituximab, which is anti-CD20, the person's going to be more immunosuppressed from that as well. So these are sort of all factors that sort of add to someone's risk in terms of developing neutropenia and having an occult infection. So an infectious source is identified in about 30% of patients, and it is believed that 80% probably of the infection probably results from the person's own endogenous flora. In terms of lines and stuff, so when the person's coming in, part of your exam, right, a lot of our oncology patients have catheters. They have indwelling catheters. So part of your exam has to be evaluating the catheter. Is there erythema around it? Is there tenderness as well? So you want to pay attention to their lines as well, their indwelling catheters as well. So I also want to think about certain types of infections. So for instance, in CLL, there tends to be chronic lymphocytic leukemia. There tends to be abnormal antibody production, functional asplenia. So you want to think of sort of encapsulated organisms. For individuals who have types of lymphoma that might result in T-cell defects, you may want to add to your sort of list of bugs that might be causing problems, sort of intracellular pathogens such as listeria. For a person who was on high-dose steroids, you want to think of things like PCP. So sort of keep in mind not just the things we sort of talked about before, like how neutropenic are they, etc. Think about what the underlying malignancy is, and also I should have added there also the drugs. I mean, certain drugs are more likely to cause, say, humoral immunosuppression. Some of the treatments for CLL themselves can cause more humoral depression, in addition to the fact that the person might be neutropenic. You always want to cover your gram negatives. You want good pseudomodal coverage. And fungal and viral infections are also possible. So what do you do initially? So a person comes in, they're neutropenic. So you pan culture them. You include cultures from the line, as well as you include a chest x-ray, urine culture as well. Further imaging will depend on what other types of symptoms a person may have. So we generally start off with cefepime, 2 grams Q8. So that's a dose for neutropenic fever. But again, I just want to point out, you know, never forget, you know, you're the one standing in front of the patient. So we may say neutropenic fever, start cefepime, 2 grams Q8. But let's say the person was recently on a 10-day course of antibiotics and they're presented with watery diarrhea. Right? What do you want to think about as well? So yes, right, so you want to make sure. So that's what I mean. Like, you know, we say neutropenic fever, there's a protocol, you know, you treat with cefepime 2 grams Q8, but never forget what the patient in front of you is telling you and what you're seeing, right? So that'll also guide you as to what additional antibiotics to give. I would still cover that patient with cefepime, but you'd also make sure that you have C. diff coverage as well, right? So you look at the patient as well. You start growth factor support. Generally, it's 5 micrograms per kilogram of Neupogen. vancomycin. We generally add vancomycin if the person is like really sick, so if they're presenting hypotensive, if they look like they have some any kind of skin infection, if they've been hospitalized recently, if they've had a recent quinolone, etc., we would probably give vancomycin. Now, in terms of further antibiotics, we tend to include an antifungal if, you know, obviously, if you, again, if you do an exam and you check the person's mouth and they have like a significant amount of thrush and, you know, their ANC is 500, you're going to think of an antifungal early on. Generally, we add antifungals when someone's been persistently febrile with neutropenia for 5 days on broad spectrum antibiotics, including VANC. We then tend to add the antifungal then. But again, there's nothing to prevent you from looking at a patient and going by what symptoms and signs that you're actually seeing in the patient. Consider catheter removal if need be. It depends on what your cultures tell you or how the catheter site looks. And again, you know, if generally a lot of these patients, if they're on patients, you're on the oncology floor, but if they happen to be not be on the floor, obviously call us. And an infectious disease consultation, they also like to follow these patients and are generally extremely helpful as well. So I'm going to go back to ones that I skipped. So I like to talk about the hypercalcemia just because it's something that we see in oncology, in our oncologic patients. So I just like to briefly review that. So occurs in 10 to 20% of cancer patient. It could be secondary to bony mets. It can also be due to a paraneoplastic syndrome, associated most commonly with myeloma, squamous cell lung cancer, renal cancer, breast cancer at times, many head and neck tumors, some leukemias, cancer of unknown primary is also up there. Prostate cancer also, I should put one, when it's a widely metastatic to the bones, that can cause that as well. So whether or not there are symptoms from the hypercalcemia, then it generally depends on the speed of which the hypercalcemia develops. If someone takes a long time to develop hypercalcemia, they'll generally not be as symptomatic compared to someone where the hypercalcemia developed really quickly. Sort of general things that the symptoms that it can cause: dehydration, anorexia, pruritus, weight loss, fatigue. I always remember a case in the clinic, one of the second year fellows just, now I forget what malignancy the gentleman had, but it was interesting because the fellow just sort of, and this is again comes from just like talking to a patient and knowing a patient. He was talking to a patient who really didn't have any specific complaints, other than he was maybe a little bit more tired than usual, but the fellow was sort of bugged by the fact that he seemed a little bit slower, like just even in terms of writing things, the patient just seemed really slow and just not as upbeat himself. You know, he drew, said, okay, let me just check his labs, and, you know, as it turns out, his calcium was really high. And again, he had no other complaints, just like not feeling himself, and the fellow just noticing that he just wasn't as quick as he usually was. CNS symptoms, weakness, hypotonia, proximal myopathy, mental status changes, etc. You can have cardiac abnormalities, GI abnormalities, constipation is a big one. And renal, you can have obviously polyuria and nephrocalcinosis as well. So diagnosis, you check your ionized calcium. You can check your PTH-related protein, 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. In terms of treatment, if the calcium is only mildly elevated, for example, if it's less than 12 and no symptoms, you can just encourage a person to drink a lot of fluids. Make sure you go through their meds. That's another thing, right? So you go through their medication to make sure there's not any meds, like especially certain types of diuretics, right, that can be exacerbating the situation. So you want to eliminate any offending agents. So if the calcium is greater than 12 or they have symptoms. So even if it's less than 12, if you think the person's having symptoms from their hypercalcemia, you want to address that. So you want to give, we say aggressive IV fluid hydration. Obviously, you want to pay attention to what the person's cardiac function is, what their renal function is. Once euvolemia is achieved, and I put that because, you know, you don't want to be starting diuretics, right? A lot of times, like, people who are severely hypercalcemia, they may have a lot of polyuria, they may actually become dehydrated. So before you get loop diuretics on board, you want to make sure that you make the person euvolemic, you hydrate them, monitor their eyes and nose, and once euvolemia is achieved, you can add a loop diuretic. Again, you want to follow their urine output as well as their other electrolytes. In terms of what we use from a pharmacologic standpoint to help us treat hypercalcemia, generally, we like the bisphosphonates. They inhibit osteoclast function. Set of action, though, if you notice, is 24 to 48 hours. And I want to make that point because the second drug on the list that I have there is calcitonin, which acts very quickly, right? But it's short-acting. So calcitonin has an onset of action 2 to 4 hours, effective of short duration. So we'll see sometimes, you know, I don't know, if someone has a calcium of, let's say, 16, right, and they're coming in really severe hypercalcemia, you know, they're symptomatic from it, that's a person that you may want to consider, you know, you obviously do your hydration, but you may want to consider calcitonin in that individual to get them down to a reasonable level, and maybe you can do a bisphosphonate later depending on where they level off at. So I want you to keep in mind the onset of action. So the bisphosphonate is not going to act for, you know, 24 for 48 hours, but your calcitonin will act relatively quickly. Okay? There are some other drugs that are used. To be honest, I've never had occasion to use these drugs, but they are there and have been used with hypercalcemia for gallium nitrate and plecomycin. But again, the agents of choice that we've used here, or at least I've used both as a fellow and as an attending, I've generally not needed anything beyond calcitonin and a bisphosphonate and, you know, aggressive IV fluid hydration, and just really being careful about monitoring the lights, etc. So I'm actually going to end here. Are there any questions?
What causes dehydration with calcium? I know it's polyuria, but what causes the polyuria with hypercalcemia?
Well, the calcium actually has an effect on the tubules, and it's one of the ways, say, like in... Yeah, it actually has an effect on the tubules, which is part of the reason that there is the polyuria. The exact mechanism, I'm not going to get into because I haven't looked at it in a while.
Maybe it's a smaller, hyperosmolar
state. Yes, you're right. That's it? Okay.
Thank you. How expensive is that other drug, Resmuritane, was it?
So you bring up a good point. I can tell you the exact number.
It's not like a drug we can basically prophylax almost every patient.
No, right? No. I mean, to be honest, the times that I've had to use it, I've actually had to... Let me take this off.